Welcome to the Bill Cartwright Show with Steve Cohen. Our special guest is author, educator, and negotiation expert, and I'm very curious about, Maury Taharapour. Maury, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor. It's a pleasure being here. Hi, Steve.
Well, don't be honored by Steve. I'm always very curious about people, where they come from. Can you talk a little bit about where you grew up and talk a little bit about your parents?
Sure. So first generation Iranian American, and we immigrated to the U.S. at the brink of the Iranian Revolution. So it was 78, 79. My mom and I came out together because my sister and my brother had sort of been shipped out to the US already, just when they got old enough to get their education. So they were actually in high school when they had come out to the US. I was just far too young. So we left shortly after the revolution began, and we were later joined by my dad. So my entire family have moved out to the U.S. at that point. We moved to first Lowell, Massachusetts, and then to Brookline, Massachusetts. This is sort of the heyday of the Celtics, which is important because that's sort of where I started getting the love of sports, was really sort of, you know, Boston is kind of that sports town, right? So we were like three blocks from Fenway Park. We could actually see the lights go on in the park for the games in the evenings. And like I said, the Celtics were, at that time, there was, you know, Celtics, Lakers, and the Sixers, really a little bit of Detroit, but that was my first like love of sports. What is this thing where people all come together? Because we had just come from a sort of conflict ridden country at that point. So fast forward that, we then moved a little later to New Jersey, where I went to high school, and then I went to college in Manhattan. My whole family moved out to California when I was in college. I think they just got sick of the East Coast weather and moved to greener and warmer pastures. And so in my heart of hearts, I'm an East Coast person. My family has now been in California long enough. I joined them after college for a bit, and now I actually came back to the East Coast and live in DC. A little bit about my parents. Very traditional Iranian family. I think my dad had always wanted one of his kids to become a doctor. And my first was my brother, and he didn't. He's 16 years older than me. Then it was my sister, and she didn't. She was 10 years older than me, and I was like the last hope. And I sit in front of you today not as a doctor, so that didn't go up as planned either. And that's been a real kind of, and we can talk about this later, but that was a very difficult thing that I've struggled with all my life, because there's always that notion of, you know, did I let them down? But that was just really important. Education was very important to my family, particularly when it came to me. Like I said, they left the country for me. And I've sort of been carrying that burden, if you will, my entire life. But suffice it to say, I didn't go to medical school route, but I've had quite the interesting and very diverse career. So I'm sure we'll get to that. But older parents, they're both now struggling with sort of the ills of aging. So early stage dementia, which has been really difficult. But I don't think my story is that much different than most of the immigrant stories that we hear.
Well, can you talk about where you went to school? And then I want you to talk a little bit about your first job. I want to know what your thoughts were.
Yeah. So when we were in Brookline, Massachusetts, and I got a later appreciation for this, which was sort of going to school in a place where the public schools were fantastic. And when we went and moved to New Jersey, I ended up actually only going to public school for a year, and then went to a private school in Englewood, New Jersey. And from there, and I loved that area. I considered myself sort of a New Yorker in some ways, maybe I still do, but I went to school in Manhattan. I went to Barnard at Columbia University. And so my college education was very much in the midst of Manhattan, 116th Street and Broadway. And that's the 4 years that I spent there for college, were the last on the East Coast. Then I moved to California and had a career in public health, and then moved on to become an entrepreneur. And then decided to go back to school and get my MBA, and went to the Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania, which is where I teach now. And my first job, oh my God, Bill, I just turned 50. That was a very long time ago. What I will tell you, it's like, you know, I did the regular, the kids thing, the babysitting. And then when I got to college, I was paying for my own education. So I had a million jobs. I did worked in the lab at the school. I did telemarketing for Columbia. I did, you know, all sorts of anything I could get my hands on. I was doing internships at the time because I was pre-med in college. So I was working in doctor's offices and then St. Luke's Hospital. And ended up actually, the thing I'll point to is that because I was really paying for my own education, I started working at a hotel while I was still in high school and worked at the front desk and then worked in the restaurant. So I spent most of my college career actually waitressing on the weekends just to make enough money to pay school and my own sort of expenses. And that may have been one of the best jobs ever for me because it taught me a few things. It taught me to be very patient, right? Because that was the only way you're going to make some tips is be kind and patient and service oriented. So, and there were times I remember when things would be so crazy in the restaurant and I have a propensity to get very stressed. So that job sort of had me learning how to sort of dealing with, you know, putting out fires and customers and complaints all at once. And as I look back, I think it was my ability to come down in like highly stressed environments and be able to just deal with it. And because I was so focused on the customer, I sort of had this mentality that like everything's gonna work out. And it's helped me throughout my life. Like that is a job that the lessons I learned from it, never mind the having to work hard to make the money to be able to live and pay for my education. But it really taught me a lot about interacting with all kinds of different people. And I carried that forward with me. So that's, In a weird way, waitressing was a really great opportunity for me to learn how to work with very different people and stay curious and calm and service oriented throughout.
Can you talk about your book and your thoughts about negotiation? That's a subject that I'm very familiar with, whether you're trying to get people to believe in you, to see how you kind of fit in, and also how you enhance that kind of organization. So what are your thoughts in these kind of negotiations?
So, let me talk a little bit about why I even started teaching. So when I went to Wharton and took negotiations, I had been an entrepreneur for years before that. And when I took my negotiations class, learned a lot in that class and was asked by my then professor and now mentor and friend, Ken Shropshire, who is very well known in the sports industry. So we had this conversation about me wanting to be in sports in some way. And he was open to sort of helping me and really sort of guiding me through networks and conferences and what have you. But then he said, I think you should teach. And I thought he was nuts because I was, you know, sort of an introvert, did not do well, I thought, the thought of public speaking and standing in front of a classroom. But he urged me nonetheless, and I guess he won that negotiations because I find myself 17 plus years later still teaching at Wharton. And I start that off to say that when I first took the class, I didn't think of negotiations the way I think about it now. And it was through the process of learning the art itself. And it is an art, it is a learned skill. It is much like any leadership skill, but allowing myself to define it in my own way and using my own experiences to understand what it meant to me. And it was that sort of juxtaposition of what we learn in school about negotiations and then my own experiences of how I showed up in a classroom that has sort of brought me to the point of writing this book, but really my own philosophy around negotiations, which is anybody can be a great negotiator. We do this every day, all day in one way, shape or form, right? It doesn't have to be contract negotiations. It could be a big personal decision. What are you going to wear that day? Negotiating with kids and parents and all the rest of it. And so it's something that surrounds us every day. We're actively involved in it. And yet most people are really afraid of it because they only really think about negotiations as those sort of transactional win-loss situations. And the minute people do that, their fear, their anxiety around it really precludes them from doing what I think is important, which is thinking about themselves, feeling authentic, coming to the table with their own values and their own perspectives and using their own voice, because they're all the while trying to be something that they're not because they've seen in the movies or they've read that a great negotiator is really aggressive. But if that's not your persona, they think then they're not a great negotiator. And there's all of these myths that surround negotiations. And the God's honest truth is, if I thought that's what negotiations was, I would not be here teaching it. But I've found that negotiations is this beautiful sort of elegant dance between two people or three people or even with yourself, which is really a process of decision making and problem solving and finding the opportunity to speak your voice and ask for things that are important to you, listening to other people, learning about them. So that's sort of my perspective on it. I don't know if that answered the question, but it's really sort of, I take a much bigger view of it than sort of that kind of win-loss transactional perspective.
So when you negotiate, do you try to develop some kind of personal relationship with that person?
Yeah, I think that life is about relationships. And I think negotiations is for sure about relationships, because whether, again, it's a relationship with yourself and better knowing yourself, or meeting people and creating those opportunities to learn from them, connect with them. Because, I mean, you both know, not every negotiations comes to a conclusion the very first time you sit at a table with someone. So a lot of it becomes, like I said, this dance, this back and forth. And so when you create relationships or you focus on a relationship in negotiations, there's more of a long-term perspective. So it doesn't become, what are we going to do today? But how can we evolve in this conversation so that this can become a long-term trajectory, a long-term opportunity? So if not today, then maybe the next time. And if not the next time, maybe some other time. I always talk about sort of the Maya Angelou quote that, you know, people may not remember what you said or what you did, but they'll forever remember how you made them feel. And it's that notion of leaving a good impression and looking, having a long-term view from a relationship perspective that I think makes for successful negotiations.
Do you think there's different negotiations for sports and corporate America?
At the end of the day, not really. I think that, because if you really think about it, it's always some kind of a problem that you're trying to solve, right? So that back and forth. And so the subject may be different, but it's really the personalities that are different. So it's not like when I teach negotiations, I don't say to them, this is the only way you can negotiate. It's more about, who are you? What are your values? What are the things that are driving you or motivating you to have this conversation? So when you think about it from that perspective, my personality may be very different than yours or somebody else's. So that ultimately changes the way you come into the negotiations. But as far as what you're trying to accomplish, it's really just inherently at the end of the day, what the focus of that conversation is, but not the way I think it should work, which is still all the fundamentals. Be curious, be prepared, be focused on relationships, have a long-term view. So whether it's sports or corporate America or even personal relationships, I think they sort of have the same framework. It's just the people and the situations that make it different.
Stevie?
I think that another aspect that we should address is you've worked with a lot of athletes like Bill, when they come to the end of their career. And what did you learn from that?
Oh, so much. You know, I've had the great privilege of working with some of the like very best athletes in their own right, in their own sport. And I have to say that I've worked with them through a number of different ways. Before I went into sort of what I do now and Wharton, I did a lot of social marketing, which was wrapping healthcare messages and education around professional athletes, entertainers, and using them as a platform for sort of social change and education. So that was the one thing that, you know, that was still not, at the end of the day, truly understanding the mind of athletes in a way that I think I now do. And it was through servicing and working with these athletes from an academic perspective, right? I became an academic, I was a teacher, and did not expect, and this is, you know, again, a learning process, when I would sit in a classroom or teach 40 some odd NFL players at all ranges of their career, right? Some had already retired, some were in the middle of their career, and some really early sort of rookies. What I was amazed by is, first of all, the amount of focus that they could actually sit there for like 7 hours and listen to us. And I was like, I don't know how they're doing this, but you know, it quickly dawned on me that that's what it means to sit with your coach and learn the plays and study the playbooks. And so there was that side of it, right? The transferable skill sets and the drive and the interest. And when they weren't forced into being in that classroom, but wanted to be there, the dedication and the wherewithal, even the intellectual curiosity. But what I found was that it was a safe space in some ways, right? Nobody was judging them. Nobody was saying that just because you don't know how to do accounting, like it's terrible. We were saying, look at the skills that you do have. You have had a career. You know, people are like, well, I don't know what to put on my resume more. I haven't had a job. I was like, you're a professional athlete. That's a job. That, you know, it's very different than maybe somebody else does, but all the resilience, all the hard work, all the preparation that it takes to be who you are, those are all transferable skills. And so that became kind of the conversation, was really allowing them to better understand themselves in a non-judgmental way that said, you know, here's your opportunity to maybe find this next chapter of your career that, look, will probably never be as exciting as what this is, right? You don't have people in the stands cheering from you and a fan base. And every time you make a basket, that some, you know, you've got a whole cheering section, like that doesn't happen in life, right? But you can find something that's different that may still be exciting to you, but in a very, very different kind of way. And oh, by the way, you can be really good at it. It doesn't mean that just because you haven't had that experience, you cannot succeed. And that's been a lot of this sort of transition conversation is allowing people who've had this unbelievable, very unique career, find their own power and their own strength and their own wherewithal and really an understanding of their own voice and their choices to become really good at something else that could bring them happiness and fulfillment. And it's been a privilege. I have to say it is when people talk about athletes, why do they make so much money? And, you know, I'm the very quick, like, let's not have this conversation, because I get very passionate around it. Only because I don't know if people really understand what it takes to do what our professional athletes do. Never mind the fact that they entertain us and they bring us joy and all of that, and that the responsibility of that alone, but they're human beings, right? And they go on to like that second part of their life. What is that thing about like professional athletes have really the three lives? It's like when they're born, right, when they go into their professional career, and then the life thereafter. And that's those chapters happen to just be really different than most people, but they're really not. At the end of the day, they still have the same vulnerabilities, the same challenges. And I've just had a really great time being able to have that experience working with these athletes and helping in whatever way I could.
I have two questions. Okay, what are the type of athletes that do the best job adjusting? What is it about them that makes them adjust? And then also, what makes somebody a very good negotiator? Now, I would think it's simple just to say, like, you're willing to walk away. Like, you in your mindset are like, okay, you know, you're not as dependent on getting that contract. And Bill can speak to it better, but, or deal, right? So what makes you successful in negotiating and adjusting to life pro after sports?
I think the adjustment is hard for anybody. And like I said, that's not very different than anybody else's careers, right? Starting something new that you feel like you haven't had experience in is difficult, and it's vulnerable and it's scary. I think the athletes that do best though are the ones that have come to the understanding that they will not forever play professional sports. And they realize that early on. And not to say that they're giving up on their career, but really to say, when this ends, I want to have a plan B. I want to have some plan around what I'm going to do next, because I'll never make money like this again in this sort of short spurts, right? And so that can't be the measure of how successful I am. So there's that, there's the financial planning around it. But the mentality of, and this too shall end, and I will be able to find something that won't be the same, it won't feel the same, I won't have the camaraderie that I have in a locker room, but I'm gonna find something else that I'm curious about, that I can succeed in. And I find that a lot of athletes go through different phases of that too. Like, they won't jump from, you know, professional sports to their next career and stay there forever, because it's a journey, it's a self-discovery. But I think the earlier on they start preparing for that transition, even if they play for another decade, the more opportunities they have to find more successfully that next step, because they've maybe taken internships during the off season. They've met with people during the time that they're playing. They have created networks that are going to help them next. So not being singularly focused on what's in front of them right now, but really challenging themselves to think about what's next and what makes for a great negotiator. Curiosity, I think. It's funny, I would use the same answer for what I just told you. Like, having the curiosity to think that life will always be this way and figuring out what you need to navigate the next road. So in negotiations, being confident that you're really prepared, but being humble enough to know that you don't know everything, and going into negotiations, wanting to learn and be respectful of the knowledge that your counterpart is bringing to the table, and seeing them and being open to them and being respectful, but really with a learning mindset throughout.
Maury, I do think that is really interesting, because we've had players either have their agents, or some players, I'll give you an example, like John Paxson. John Paxson would take his contract in and actually give it to the GM and say, I just want you to pay me what you think I'm worth. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. He always ended up with a better contract because he made them think about what value he has to the team. So my agent, when I first got in the league, was this guy, Bob Wolf. And I can promise you, he would kill you with kindness. Yep. I thought his whole group was, these people cannot be this nice, but it was just really amazing that kindness that he showed and respect to the people he was negotiating with, you always got a better contract. So I really love that idea of different thoughts in negotiation. And besides, that's who we are anyway.
Right.
You know, I want kindness, I want respect, and that's what I want to give.
You know what the first reading is in my class, Bill?
I do not know.
It's an article by Bob Wolf.
Oh, that is really amazing.
That's what starts my semester. For my Wharton students, it is the very first reading on my syllabus. Because, well, first of all, as you know, Bob Wolf didn't want to be referred to as an agent, that somebody thought. Like, he wouldn't call himself that. But, you know, that's amazing to me, actually. I'd love to talk to you more about that. But the fact is that his, and this could be, you know, I don't know whether this is true or not, but his reputation, as you know, the reason why he got these deals is because he had relationships.
Yes.
And there's I don't know whether this is myth or true, but there's this thing that Bob Wolf, when he would make his first offer, that they would always get accepted, which is really unusual in whether it's sports or negotiations. But I think part of that came from the fact that he knew people, he knew these teams, he knew the GMs, but he also knew his players. And it wasn't like you win, we lose, or if we get more money, you lose. It was the, let's figure out why this works, and then let's look at the true value. And that's problem solving at its best, right? But then really based on relationships. And he always said, leave something on the table, right? The winning doesn't mean you take it all. You just leave a little bit on the table, because that's what's gonna keep you being invited back again. So I love that. That's a conversation for us, Bill, because that is my very first reading in my class. for my students to understand that negotiations isn't about a win-lose proposition, that really the best of the best never thought about it that way.
Well, he did have a lot of great clients like Carl Yastrzemski. Fortunately for me, Birdman was in my class. So Larry Bird was his agent as well. So he did have, I believe, a great pulse on what was going on in the league at the time.
Absolutely.
And what players' worth were. So our league then was forever changing, especially in sports where the average life for an NBA player is less than 3 years. So it's that idea, yeah, you're preparing
right
for your future. It's a little bit different beast now because of those great salaries that I love. I love to see guys get those salaries because for one thing, they're available, and it really allows for the athletes to not only make a great living, but really to become something else in helping others, because, you know, you could really be done after two contracts if you want to be, if you've invested your money right.
Right. Not to mention injuries and all the rest of it. So absolutely.
And so it's a little different beast now. I wish I had a little piece of that beast now.
Yeah, it's a lot different, I guess, whether it's baseball or basketball. But yeah, there's a lot of money, a lot of money.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's gonna allow for those teams not to stay together because guys are really inclined, if they can make some more money, they're out of here, whether you win it. And it's really remarkable. I can win a championship. Imagine those Celtic teams. Oh. Yeah. I just won a championship, your second championship, but I'm out of here.
Right. You wanted to
twice as much money somewhere else.
You wanted to keep wearing that jersey, right? You know, that doesn't happen anymore. Like this, it's just, like you said, a completely different beast. It's a true business. Free agency, I think, changed all of that. But yeah, I remember, as you do, you know, you were sort of a Knick for life, or a member of the Celtics for life. There was some pride in retiring as such. So it's a different world. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of money. And if the players don't get it, the owners do. So I'm really actually okay with the players getting as much money as they do.
Stevie, I want to give you the last shot at this.
I think that this was a fantastic conversation, and do you think this is true or not? The expression, you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate.
I do. Maybe part of it is just the way I was raised. I mean, I'm not that person who just, like, the silver platter thing was not true in my life, right? So I've worked really hard for everything. And I think negotiations is sort of like this extension of that. If you don't ask, people don't just give you things, right? That's, at least that's not the fortune that I've had. And that, you know, you have to treat people a certain way to be treated a certain way. And that fundamentally, I think, like, kindness and respect and all those things really matter, because again, it's not just what you deserve, it's sort of what you put out there. And if you want more, you can't beat that out of people. You have to treat them a certain way so that they would be persuaded to do so, right? And persuasion doesn't come through aggression. So, you know, I think all those things, they're really life lessons that create success in negotiations. But unfortunately, people are afraid, and they're afraid of asking, and they're afraid of, this is the gender pay gap, for example. But if you don't ask, you're not going to get it. And you have to sort of create your own fortune and your own good luck and your own opportunities. So you go to the table, you ask, and the worst that could happen is somebody else say no. But I just don't have experience with people just handing me things. So yeah, if I don't ask, I certainly wouldn't be here today.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Having read the book a bunch of times, I've learned a lot. So I encourage everybody to buy Bring Yourself. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Lauren, thank you so much. You and I need to have another conversation, at least one or two. I'm very curious about a lot of your thoughts, and I agree with them so much about negotiations and thoughts and how people feel and getting what they really want. So thank you so much for being
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'd welcome that opportunity, but thank you very much. It's been an honor. Thank you so much.